Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. It goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, social media, how to use Twitter and Facebook without getting the sack. And also the secret rulers of the world. Well, not exactly the world. The NATO zone are meeting in a week or so's time, the Bilderberg conference. I talked to Patrick Henningsen from the 21st Century Wire. And a weekly What's On guide from Jeff Sparks. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733 or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk, and I'll repeat their contact details at the end of the show. But we start this week with Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And I'm joined now by Patrick Henningsen. Hi, Patrick, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony. How are you?
Absolutely fine. Now, just tell us a little bit about the 21st Century Wire and your background.
Okay. Yes, I founded a website, which was a blog called 21stCenturyWire.com about 4 years ago, 4.5 years ago. And I'm a normal citizen who became, involved in the call it the anti-war movement, and I started writing, and I have a background in corporate communications and graphic design.
Great. Well, who did you work for as part of that? That sounds interesting. Corporate communications. This is PR, isn't it, for the big boys?
Yeah, I did. I did some interesting work. I worked in a little bit in the fashion industry and the sports industry. And also the electronics and technology industry, which was the most interesting because it's very competitive, and I got a little insight into how these companies go after each other in the blogs. So it was really interesting.
How do you mean go after each other in the blogs?
Well, when a new product is being launched, there's normally a race between two, three, or four companies, sometimes in different countries. And so they try like heck to promote their product, to say that they can do things that they absolutely cannot do, or that they're this much faster than the next one, and they're really not. Most of them are pretty much the same, and they make up all sorts of stories and pay thousands and thousands and millions of dollars. They pay different people. They have events, product launches, to exaggerate the performance of their Coke versus Pepsi. It tastes exactly the same.
Now, corporate communications, public relations, what did that teach you about the news we get from day to day? Because, I would imagine, actually working in that world is quite an insight into not just into the world you're working in, but how the media, the mainstream media works.
What it gave me an insight into is that there's a lot of news, Tony, that you see on the newspapers, on television, that's not news, actually. It's been paid for. It's been placed there by PR companies or directly by the corporations themselves who have produced a news segment or have sent them footage, and then you have the newsreader talking over it as if it's as something that the news crew produced. I don't know if you have any experience, from the BBC, if you've seen that process happen, but I see a lot of headlines on the front of a lot of tabloids about statins, and I know exactly where that story comes from. It comes from the producers of those products.
How would you say is best, because obviously you do, as I do, we read between the lines, we'll say, well, hang on a minute, I don't trust that story, I don't trust that newsreader, I don't trust that outlet. How can you make that decision about whether a news story is genuine, it's finding its way through the system because it's genuinely of importance, and distinguishing between that and the spin, the public relations, where someone's actually just trying to sell you something at the end of the day?
Yeah, well, PR, the term public relations was invented by people like Mr. Edward Bernays or Mr. Lippmann in the 20th century, And that was a term they did to rebrand propaganda. So all public relations really is fundamentally is propaganda, but it's been given a nice soft, you know, progressive term of public relations. But to know what's what, it's a very complex playing field, and it's really up to you to, you know, read a lot of different news sources. I read everything I can get my hands on in order to try triangulate, you know, what's real and what's not, and what's been derived from a PR campaign or what's being pushed. Because PR companies aren't just for toothpaste and mouthwash anymore. Political parties are actually hiring very expensive PR consultants in order to spin their propaganda, or individuals hire them in order to, you know, make them look good after a scandal has damaged their credibility, etc. So Max Clifford comes to mind. So it's highly complex, but it's, I think most people, you can use common sense, Tony, and they, if they know the media playing field a little bit, they can pretty much sniff a rat when it walks into the room.
Yes, certainly. And I mean, that statin story is a great example, because a lot of it is, the idea is this is a dispassionate discussion about statins, but actually one of the sides there has paid somebody a lot of money to go in and bat for the statins, the drug companies, the pharmaceutical companies. I think, you know, fascinating to see some of the spin around the takeover by Pfizer of AstraZeneca, or the attempted takeover. There's absolutely multi-millions of profits at stake here, but that side of it isn't often dissected by the journalists. That's the problem. Anyway, we've got a particular interest. Both of you and I both keep an eye on the Bilderberg conferences. They started back in the 1950s with the former SS officer chairing them. That's Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, after the war. And he was supposed to be a sort of nice, honest broker. I think a lot of people now speculating that actually there was still a little bit of SS blood running in his veins. But the Bilderbergs still meet. They're meeting this month, the end of this month, in a week or so's time, over in Copenhagen. I wonder, what's your take on whether the Bilderbergs are as powerful as some people say, or whether they are really just a private club having a little chit chat on the quiet, and you know, a bit of security, and whether it's an innocent thing, or whether these people are really wielding more power than we know?
Well, they're definitely not just a private club that goes and meets to play golf once a year in exotic or not so exotic locations like London or Switzerland, but they are a very real organization. That you can trace their roots back to just after the end of the Second World War, and if you look at some of the accomplishments that we know now through you know, declassified documents or some very good books have been written. The European Union, the single currency itself, having its roots in actual steering committee meetings in the early days of the Bilderberg Group. But more to the point, in 2014, we're sort of probably about, you know, 30 or 40 years in of the culmination of research by a lot of individual independent journalists and researchers over the years that have exposed Bilderberg to the public. And I think right now Bilderberg is going through a little transition. They had a bit of a coming out party last year when they gave their guest list, or their guest list anyway, to the Telegraph newspaper. That was a first. And of course, a lot more media attention. And, you know, I think Charlie Skelton in The Guardian has done a pretty good job of elevating that issue into the mainstream public through his columns and covering it since 2008. And now it's kind of become more mainstream. So, but when Bilderberg started, Tony, they didn't have as many of these kind of high-flying confabs like they have now. We have Davos, World Economic Summit in late January, early February. That's in Switzerland. We also have the G8, the G20 meetings, and we've got a number of these other meetings that they've managed to. You know, I think the Bilderberg's important for these leaders from politics and from industry to come together to rubber stamp decisions on issues that affect big corporations, banks, and politicians in the transatlantic sphere, which is North America, Europe, and of course they bring in a few people to color up the guest list. But essentially, I think a lot of decisions are also being made, Tony, at some of these other meetings now that didn't exist 50 years ago.
Okay, so Patrick, what is studying the Bilderberg conferences and the organization, the Bilderberg meetings, taught you about the way power really works in the world?
Well, it's funny because my understanding has come together a little bit, especially last year when I saw Google had its big tent meeting in Watford, I believe a week or two before the actual Bilderberg conference was scheduled. And there was a big row out in public, and they said, oh, Google's not paying their fair share of corporate tax. How horrible this is. And George Osborne weighs in. He's a career Bilderberger, and other people weighed in. And then all of a sudden, we start hearing a call for a global taxation system. Surprise, surprise. And, of course, that was a big piece of the discussion, I believe, at Bilderberg last year. So you can kind of look and see what global issues get ballooned in the media in the run-up to Bilderberg. And then you've got the G8 last year in Ireland was directly afterwards. And, of course, they were talking about global tax for corporations. And, of course, the big corporations will not ever pay their fair share of tax, whether it's an issue or not. They're talking about tax for you and I, for the global citizen under their new regime. It's taught me to watch the media, Tony, in the run-up to Bilderberg and after, and see what the sort of global corporate, the one world corporate order, which is what I think it is, Trans-Pacific Partnership, a transatlantic trade and investment partnership. That's Bilderberg to me.
And the other thing, of course, is that both George Osborne, Peter Mandelson from the Labour Party, George Osborne from the Conservative Party, we've also got Ed Balls from the Labour Party, David Cameron from the Conservative Party. It seems on the key economic issues, whichever way you vote, you still vote for Bilderberg. So what about ordinary folks like us? What can we actually do to change things if whichever way we vote, we still get a Bilderberg economic policy?
Yeah, that's the problem. The problem, Tony, with Bilderberg and the problem with Davos, Davos is becoming more and more like Bilderberg. They're having closed session meetings during Davos where we have our elected officials showing up and meeting other policymakers from other countries and making decisions outside of our democratic process, even outside of the EU process, which you could hardly call democratic. But this is a huge problem. So basically, this subverts the whole concept of democracy. It subverts the whole concept of having constituency and electing their representative, going to parliament, making decisions on behalf of the constituency, and it's transparent. And so there's no transparency with Bilderberg. This is a big problem. So you could have decisions that are going to affect the lives of you, your family, your community, your nation, and you're out of the loop completely.
Yeah, but so what can we do?
Well, we've done, I think people, especially alternative media, have done a lot of good work to expose Bilderberg, to bring the issue out into the fore, but my fear is they're going to crawl under another rock, and they've already started another confab at a certain time of the year to make steering committee decisions. I think what we have to do is enforce things like the ministerial code, clarify that, where what is the minister's ability to go and meet while they're in elected positions.
Well, that's an interesting one, isn't it? Because, with these various ministers going to Bilderberg in Watford last year, they are actually breaking the ministerial code. So maybe what we have to do is just make sure that if any of our politicians do step into these secret meetings where they're making decisions, discussions all in secret, none of it, they are sworn by Chatham House rules not to disclose what's being talked about in there. So if any of them do that to make it hurt, in other words, they will lose their parliamentary position, their government position, and even stop being an MP if they enter those meetings under those terms.
I think you should be disqualified from office if you choose to attend a meeting like that. And in America, we have a law passed called the Logan Act, which is essentially the same thing. And it means that you can't sort of collude outside of the democratic process away from your constituency with foreign entities while you're in office. If you're a private businessmen, that's fair enough. You can't do much about the corporates. But the fact when you got corporates intermingled with elected officials, to me, smells to high heaven of something that we absolutely should not stand for.
Totally agree. Can you just finish off, wind up, Patrick, by telling us about your website and where people can catch you online or on the radio, that kind of thing?
Yeah, you can catch myself and our reports at 21stCenturyWire.com, and you can catch me every Sunday on the Sunday Wire radio show, which is a three-hour talk radio show between 5 to 8 p.m. GMT time.
And whereabouts can we find that online, that radio show?
You can find that at 21stCenturyWire.com. We've got a live player on every Sunday night. And the archives of all the shows are available on our radio page on the website.
And I guess you'll be covering Bilderberg at the end of May, beginning of June this year.
Yeah, we'll definitely be seeing what's going on with Bilderberg. And we're really focused on the Ukraine and the economy and what's being planned for another run at Syria this summer.
Patrick Henningsen, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thanks, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Time for our tech roundup now with Elia Pablo. Ed's still away, but we're hoping you'll be back in a few weeks' time. Ed Lander, that is, our super tech expert, so we have to cope without him. Anyway, Elia, this week, some advice for responsible use of social media. This is Twitter, Facebook. Some people really don't want to go there, do they? Because they're worried that particularly if they say something, their boss might like it, they might lose their job. So is there anything we can do to use that social media responsibly?
Well, I think you have to be responsible of what you do. Once you are aware of the power of social media and you act in consequence, you will be fine there. The problem is you have to know you are not just talking to your friends, you are talking to everyone. And everyone at some point can see what you write maybe 3 years ago, even your future employees or job expectations that you didn't have at that time. Now you may lost a job, you may lose a job, or you may lose an opportunity for what you said in the past. Like, some advices I would say is, first of all, be aware of having a personal social media profile and a professional one, especially for journalists. If you have a personal one, you have to make sure it's private, and you have to know who do you have. So if you express opinions that you think your boss is not likely to like, don't add him on Facebook. That's a quite normal advice, but lots of people forget about it.
And but you see, with Facebook, there's a quite complicated if you to try and get your privacy settings right, you know, to know who can actually see what you're writing. And anyway, the authorities will be able to see it because a lot of this stuff is really transparent to the governments, isn't it?
In my opinion, if the authorities want to see it, they will see it. But your main worry, if you are like someone that is not in a high profile person, it's their boss or their colleagues or some sort of like interviews that he's doing. So if you have Facebook and you know how to use it, you can actually be private. You can settle which privacy do you want. You can say even that they don't find you on Facebook. So if your boss wants to find you, they cannot see you. There is a tool to do that. And then if you want someone to find you, you have to add him. So that's actually a good idea for someone that doesn't want to be found in online.
Okay, so what we're saying really is that be really absolutely specific. If you're talking about personal stuff that you think might be possibly used against you in the future, be absolutely clear about your privacy settings. Get them right before you start chit-chatting on Facebook. Twitter, though, is a bit different, isn't it? Because pretty much everybody can read Twitter. So I suppose what we're saying is that if you want your conversation to be private, don't use Twitter.
Exactly. My first advice would be don't criticize your workplace at first time. If you want to do it through anonymous Twitter. If you want to do it through Twitter, if you really want to do it. But always, if you have your personal account, never use it to express your own opinions. They can be danger to you.
Okay, this is at work. And is it, I mean, you mentioned they're talking about work things. I suppose we really need to look at some examples, don't we, of people who have used there, maybe said, oh, my boss is in a bad mood today, maybe mentioned their name, this kind of thing, that could get you sacked, couldn't it?
Definitely. There was a case of a guy that worked for a pizza company in America and criticized the new uniforms and actually hashtagged them on Twitter. Next day he was fired just for criticizing the uniform. So imagine if you actually say the name of your boss, you won't go back to the place. You don't need to.
That's amazing. So there are some companies that will constantly be monitoring this sort of thing. And if you say anything that's critical, I would suggest maybe you should be thinking about saying that to your boss at work rather than in public. Because in a way, by saying it in public, it's almost like you're going around your boss, isn't it? You're saying, well, I don't want to talk to my boss about this. I'd rather tell the public about it.
Exactly. And I think it kind of makes sense that companies control their image, because social image is very important right now. And if they get tags on Twitter, or lots of negative reports of food, uniform, or even the customer service or how they treat their employees, that's bad reports for them. So if you want to criticize your company, do it with your friends, or even, as you said, with your boss, but not do it on online.
Okay, some of what we're talking about is taken from a really useful document. I would recommend this for anybody who is worried about whether they should or shouldn't be using Facebook, Twitter, and other forms of social media in relation to their job, their job of work. Some profession for this is very important is for journalists. If they're saying something against their boss, for example, on their account, then you know there's almost certainly going to be problems for them. Now, this guidance was prepared by the National Union of Journalists New Media Industrial Council, which I was on for a while, and it's online. You'll find it online at www.nujnewmedia.org.uk, and then you go there and just search for Social Networking Advisory Guidance for Journalists. And this has been, we'll have to put a sort of rider on this, because the guidelines should not be, and it says it on the website, should not be considered authoritative in any way, and they do not have any legal force whatsoever, but they may give you some idea of the complications that might arise from ill-considered use of social media and some help in avoiding any pitfalls that could lead to disciplinary action or worse. You are encouraged to distribute the guidelines to your colleagues. And so I'm distributing them to not just a journalist, but to everybody, because I think this is really important that you should feel the confidence, Elia, to speak your mind without being worried about getting the sack.
Well, it depends. As I said, I agree that the companies have to defend themselves. And in the position of a journalist that is saying some opinions that are not together with, let's say they work for the BBC, to put an example, and they're not together with the line, how can they then, after their tweet, follow the line of the BBC, which is completely opposite of what they just said? It's kind of difficult.
It's interesting in journalism, isn't it? Because it almost assumes that there is this one line that a giant organisation takes, even though there's like 30,000 people working for them.
Exactly.
That they all have the same opinion.
The companies normally have one opinion and then the journalists will have different. So they will choose. Some journalists actually enjoy this role of being the opposite of their own company, but they allow them to do that. So,
well, it's called balance.
Yeah.
You know, where you have different points of view, that actually a really good article isn't an opinionated one. I mean, I write a lot of opinionated articles, but the best journalism really is with all different sides, all in there, different opinions in there. And a journalist, if they're able to, and a lot, of course, aren't today with our big media barons, you know, giant media corporations that do take a specific line, is to try and put everything in there, the different opinions, so the readers can make up their own minds. Also, another thing in the guidelines, it says, make clear on all personal accounts that you're speaking for yourself. Write in the first person and include a disclaimer along the following lines. The views expressed on this site are my own and do not reflect those of any organisation. So you're immediately distancing yourself from the organisation, because that's one of the things that they may say, that you're discrediting the organisation or bringing them into disrepute. And that's a good way of putting a kind of air space between you and the organisation, saying, well, I work for these people, but I also have maybe different opinions to them.
Yeah, this is a good thing. Also, like, from people that have some blogs, what I would suggest is that always talk first about your boss about these blogs. Like, I'm going to have this blog, it's going to talk about this. Even some of them are even anonymous, and they don't even mention that they are journalists or they are whatever they are, who do they work for. And it's kind of useful because you can there express whatever you want without putting in danger your work or place. Also, lots of people got fired, not because of their opinions, but about racism or even like jokes about, like, there was a guy, a comedian, that was sacked for some jokes about this tsunami 2011. So that's also, it's not related with the company, but the company don't want their image damaged because of having this sort of employees.
Well, in my experience, quite often employers identify people that they say, well, you know, this person, we don't really want them around anymore, and they may be looking for any reason to sack them, and this just gives them a reason. I mean, it's a kind of bullying technique that a lot of organisations use, especially nowadays where there's a lot of people desperate for work. They're actually looking at their employees constantly and saying, well, this one here, he's not, you know, producing as much as the others, therefore we need to find an excuse to get rid of them. And then they'll use that excuse. One of the very good bits of advice in the social networking advisory guidance for journalists is use personal email addresses to manage any personal profiles. Do not use company email addresses to register or manage any accounts, and do not update personal accounts from a computer company IP address. So what it's saying there is make sure you've got your own online presence which you can manage, because what if you lose your job? Suddenly you've lost control of all of that information and all of the blog that you've been doing up until that point.
Yes, but I think this is quite a sensible idea and a common idea. It's common sense. So if you're actually updating your website from your workplace, or you are actually using your email, your work email, through to manage your Facebook, your Twitter, that's gonna be easy for them to. And you are actually connecting it, even if you're not identifying yourself as an employee of that company, your Twitter account is somehow connected already.
Yeah, so the idea really is to try and, you know, consider anyway having two completely separate online identities, maybe one at work if you have to, and then another one completely private, totally unrelated. Anyway, fascinating stuff. We might do some more about this because there's lots and lots to get into here that doesn't often get discussed about, you know, the implications. Social networking has transformed the way we live our lives, sometimes for the worse. Sometimes it's scary stuff. And you think, you know, like you said a few weeks ago, Elia, it's like they own my life. You know, you're putting your personal comments on and they're owned by Facebook. They take them, they control them, and they can sell them. Maybe they're selling you.
Yes,
this is the trouble. You see, you know, a private company might approach them, say, I want to know details of all the people who are interested in this or interested in this, and Facebook, you know, they may do a deal, they may sell them that private information. So it's about being confident about having a relationship with this incredibly new, powerful social media tool. But that's not the only thing we're going to talk about today, because I thought we'd also mention passwords, and because there's a lot of hacking of accounts. I've had various accounts hacked over the years. I'll start off by telling you a little story about Yahoo. My Yahoo profile, I was thinking, well, I've got a nice new phone, I'd like to be able to manage my Yahoo profile from my phone. So I put my password into my phone and it came back, it was a perfectly the right password, but it came back saying, you have used the wrong password. I'm scratching my head, this is a bit strange, I haven't used the wrong password. And I use the right password again, and then it says, now you are locked out from your account and you cannot use your account at all. But hang on a minute, what are they doing? So what I think is clear, sometimes the passwords even don't necessarily work. I've had the situation just this week with my PIN number on my debit card that I'm putting in to get to buy things. Suddenly it says, no, this isn't working. So this is a bit of a complicated one where your password you're relying on isn't necessarily going to work. You know, so you hope that the password is a secret thing that always will work. It doesn't always work. Let me tell you that, folks. You know, at some point in the future, you will find your lovely little PIN number or your lovely little password doesn't actually do what you wanted it to do, even though you've got it exactly right. But anyway, how do you manage your passwords, Elia?
Well, I try to follow the instructions of these capital letters, numbers, all mixed up. It's a bit weird because, well, one of the things they actually advise you is to use different passwords for absolutely everything, which I'm sorry, but it's impossible.
It is impossible. If you've got about 30 or 40 different things you might be doing, you might have an account at four or five different websites. You may have a bank, you may be doing your banking online, you may be doing your email online, all these things. It is impossible, isn't it, to have a different one for each one, unless you're carrying around with you each to read.
Which is exactly a danger for you.
Yes, because if you lose that, someone's going to be straight into your life online.
Exactly, and if you actually have to remind, that was capital letter first, and the capital letter was the second one, it's absolutely impossible. A weird thing that happened to me this week is that I have this email that I just use for spam or when I have to register to some dodgy website that I don't really trust.
That's a really good idea, to have a special email account which you only use to register for websites that you don't really want to give them your email address.
Exactly. Publicity.
So what it will do, it will give it all the spam will go to that email address. Okay, great. So that's a good use for Hotmail or Gmail or something like that. You could even call it eliaspam@gmail.com, couldn't you?
I'm not going to reveal it, but it's something similar. It's not this, it's similar. Well, it happened to me. I don't know if it's because of the content of this email, but in the last 2 weeks, I received two different emails in my personal account that I had it related, warning that there was someone suspicious trying to get into my account. So one from Hong Kong and the other from Toledo in Spain, which it wasn't me, and it was just in that spam account. How is that? What I think is that the content.
So what you're saying is that this, you've only given this account. You don't give this account to your friends or whatever.
No.
This is only to official websites that you're trying to register. So surely whoever it is that's trying to hack in has managed to get that email address from one of the people that you've trusted, you know, with your password and everything.
Well, I didn't trust them because obviously I gave them the fake email and I was right to not trust them.
You're right, absolutely. So is there any way to tell who's been doing this?
I can just know where, which is that Hong Kong and Toledo. And I really, it surprised me because I never receive it from my personal account, which I just use for, close friends or work relative things, but I don't use it for this kind of dodgy websites or publicity. And I don't know, I think it's kind of related of what is the purpose of this other email address.
Yeah, well, they're moving towards what's called a digital ID. That's one of the things the government wants everybody to have, some kind of one digital system that you use to sign on online. It's called Smart ID. If you look online, search for Smart ID, Beast Tech, you'll find a lot of discussion online about this thing the government's trying to introduce. The only thing is, they're going to privatise it. So rather than have it run by the government, it's going to be something which is farmed off to private businesses, supposedly controlled at arm's length by the government. But this, I think, you know, what they're doing is slowly pushing us towards having one password, one system that we use to sign on for everything. I mean, you see it now, don't you? When you're signing on to quite a lot of different blogs, this kind of thing, it says sign in using your Facebook account.
Exactly, yeah. I never do it, never.
No, me
neither. I don't
neither,
trust it. Because I don't want my Facebook to know.
That's right. If you're signing in using your Facebook account into another website, what's to say that they're not going to then go straight into your Facebook account?
Yes, and about what you were saying about this ID, digital ID, I don't like it. It's like controlling you is the perfect way of controlling you.
But they'll say, hang on a minute, Elliot, they'll say, won't they, but you've got all these different identities. Why not just have one really good identity? Well, then you can do everything.
But I don't want to. I want to be free to give to this publicity website that I don't really want, but I want to get in because of any reason, a fake email that I don't use, and I'm never going to receive, I'm never going to read the emails that they send me. So why do I have to have one personal ID that what they are going to do is actually control absolutely everything. If they are already doing it with this, it's actually going to be even easier.
Okay, thanks very much. Good, interesting chat. And I think the great thing to take away from this week is set up a little email account that you just call it tonyspam@gmail.com. And every time that some annoying website wants you to sign in, whether it's the Times, the Financial Times, they're always asking you, oh yes, we want all your details, put them in here. You can send all that nonsense to your spam account. Great idea, Ellie. I'd love to hear it. And let's have some more good tips next week.
Bye-bye.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
One thing must stop if government is to regain our respect and that of the rest of the world, and that is state-sanctioned torture. By keeping torture secret, the US and British government think they can get away with it. But even with the recent revelations about extraordinary rendition, they've proved even why the government culprits think they can get away with it. Whistleblowers, though, cause massive problems for those criminals. And a great example from the 1980s is the former CIA case officer John Stockwell. He's the highest ranking CIA officer ever to blow the whistle. And here he is speaking on Alternative News magazine at the time.
A lot of people have been involved with the CIA over the years. Alternative Views News magazine.
We have with us tonight John Stockwell, the former CIA case officer who's back for an encore performance. We're going tonight to discuss the On Company Business, the documentary film that has been made recently about the CIA.
They love to brag inside the agency about the situations the CIA helped create that were so favorable to the United States. Now, what they talk about, the common denominator, is strong men they were able to put in power in key situations and governments they were able to reverse. One of these was the Shah, who was ousted in a coup, and the CIA had a counter coup and brought him back. And the CIA used to love to brag about this and what a great man the Shah was as they proceeded to train Savak and its forces. They were, of course, very close to Batista. They were very close to just about Magsaysay, the current president of the Philippines, Pak in South Korea, in country after country after country of our allies or our client states in the third world. This, you find that the CIA helped put in power the dictator or reinforced someone who had just gotten into power, train their police, train them in oppression of suppression of the people, and it worked for a decade and a half, sometimes for 20 years. But unfortunately, the people of the world, I say unfortunately from the CIA point of view, the people of the world have become too restless, and they're kicking out the dictators one after the other and turning on the United States in the process. It was a short-sighted policy, and a policy that's now, I believe, it's thoroughly bankrupt.
John, something that struck me about the movie On Company Business, the documentary, was how it revealed the relationship between the CIA and other parts of what might be called the American power structure. In other words, the unions were very active in CIA operations. Business, the multinationals were, the media were on CIA payrolls or were used as CIA mouthpieces. Federal government agencies were working in cooperation with the CIA.
I think that it proves that there has been a desire, a compulsion by the leaders of this country and the leaders of industry to function with and through a secret police organization, i.e. to bypass and subvert the way the Constitution maps out the way our government should run. For example, in Angola, the war that I wrote about, that I was so deeply involved in, there were various elements in the society, the American community, that had no interest whatsoever in having a war happen there. It was not in our national security interests in any sense of the word. But by having the CIA do it, you did not have to have public debate. The multinationals that actually were opposed to the war couldn't debate in Congress, nor could the missionaries, nor could the academics. Nor could the smaller business people with interest in Angola. You can do it secretly, and you don't have government by the people.
And it's very curious. This is a turning upside down of what one of the men in the documentary said. He was one of the ex-CIA people who did a lot of talking, but he said, I'm not one of those kiss-and-tell people like Stockwell. But he said, I think
that
somewhere...
That was Phillips, I believe.
Yeah, Phillips.
Yeah.
He said somewhere in that, what problem is the CIA that we were sending in the CIA to do things that we should have sent our army in to do?
Right.
Yeah. You know, and back to the subject of the objectivity of this film, I would like to point out that that Alan Frankovich and Howard Dratch went so far in a couple of points that they gave the establishment figures, the CIA figures, such an opportunity to speak that I think that they went beyond fairness. For example, one element in the film, one point in the film that simply makes my blood boil is where they let this Atlee Phillips, who resigned from the CIA to create the CIX's organization, to go about propagandizing and lobbying on behalf of the CIA. They allow him to say in the film that he is convinced that Phil Agee is the agent of some foreign government.
Oh.
And that, to me, is outrageous, that one, that he would say it, but that doesn't surprise me, but it should not be included in an objective film, because, of course, that is the cheapest kind of a shot, just about on a par of the level of dignity or non-dignity of the CIA, to say that, well, he attacked us, so he must be an agent of a foreign government.
There was something interesting, though, about Agee in the second part of that film. It was widely reported in the media in America, and I believe this myself, that a CIA case officer in Greece was killed because Phil Agee had revealed his address, his name, his location, and that he was therefore responsible for this CIA agent's death. Well, Agee denied that and pointed out that it was well known in Athens that for the last 20 years, a CIA case officer had lived in a certain house in a certain...
Yeah, the station chief had lived in the same house. Four successions of station chiefs had lived in the same house. And they were public figures, and I mean they had cocktail parties that the diplomatic and police community went to, that, you know, they were all going to the CIA station chief's house. Everyone in town knew that was the CIA's house. Meanwhile, the station in Athens had supported, engineered, if you will, more than one coup of the government of Greece, and also had dabbled in every situation in the Middle East. So they had a lot of bitter enemies with the station chief living in the same house. And as they point out in this, Agee points out in this film, the station chief had been ordered by headquarters to get a new house, a clean house, and he'd refused because he didn't want to drive the extra 20 minutes. Agee had not known this man while he was in the CIA and had not revealed his name. And yet, very conveniently, the CIA has used that man's death as their cudgel to go after Agee and try to make him out as to a traitor and a killer of American agents.
Well, they've hounded him all over the Western Hemisphere, and
they
also in Europe.
They've gotten him run out of four countries in Europe he was trying to live. I think one of the most interesting things about the film, Agee is such a controversial character, made so by our media and by our government, and yet I've met him. I had the pleasure in January when I was traveling through Europe. He is an individual who comes across as very calm, extraordinarily warm in human vibrations, very intellectual. He was deeply troubled by what he saw the CIA doing in Latin America and concluded the only way to fight it was to get out and write about it and expose its operations. He had a fascinating exchange with the New York Times recently where someone wrote an article saying that Agee had his right, I believe it was to his passport, but that they disagreed with him otherwise because of his exposing names. So Phil wrote a rebuttal, which they did publish, in which he pointed out that he had not revealed a CIA officer's name in well over 3 years, whereas, and he listed all of the cases, and there must have been a dozen, where the New York Times had revealed CIA officers' names and just nailed them to the wall with their hypocrisy.
Well, as you've said on previous programs that we've had with you, that overseas it's common knowledge as who is CIA agent.
Absolutely.
Or at least the American, maybe not the contract agent, but at least the case officer and where he lives and all.
85% of the CIA case officers not only are well known, but they play to that because it's glamorous to be the CIA guy, the spook.
Plus the fact that the KGB, the Russian KGB officials, have social relationships with the CIA.
Endlessly, drinking vodka together, endlessly.
In fact, I was in Germany once, and I picked up this book, Who's Who in the CIA, and they had literally thousands of people listed, including three of the neighbors that I grew up with in Falls Church, Virginia. So in certain areas of the world, it's no secret who the CIA officers
are. This gets back to the crux of the whole matter of government secrecy. in that it is the purpose of government secrecy in terms of the CIA is to keep the American public from knowing what the government is doing. The victims, the people in the countries overseas, almost always know the full truth about the bloody operations that are killing them and messing up their lives. Secrecy is designed to keep the American people from knowing about it. The point of that is the CIA's big push for greater secrecy and protection of its secrets is not to keep enemy agents from knowing what it's doing. They know. It's to keep it's political. It's to keep the American public, the electorate, from knowing what it's doing, because the American public could rise up and vote the CIA out of existence. Therefore, it's hammering away to muzzle me and SNAP and AG. It cannot exist with an educated public. If it continued its operations of killing people overseas, of experimenting on American citizens with drugs and drug sex mind control experiments, the American people would rise up and put it out of business. The only way it can continue its operations is to have secrecy to keep the American public from knowing what it's doing with this particular $13 billion a year that it spends.
I think one of the distressing issues of this whole complex of things that you just raised is how the media has been, up until this movie On Company Business and a couple other PBS discussions or documentary, the media has been glorifying the CIA. The most striking example, and I think the On Company Business really reveals this, is the story of Dan Matroni, mm-hmm. a CIA agent in Uruguay.
We were unsuccessful in our efforts to weaken the left in Uruguay during the period when I was in Uruguay, 1964 to 1966. Our job, in the face of the growth of the strength of the left during that period, was to promote repression. It was the only alternative we had. In 1966, we brought in a CIA officer who set up his office in the police department under the cover of the public safety mission of AID. This officer was to work exclusively with the police intelligence, trying to improve its capabilities. This officer was still there in 1970 at the time that the American Public Safety Mission chief, Dan Mitrione, was kidnapped and executed by the Tupamaros.
Mitrione was the small city cop in Richmond, Indiana. He had advanced to the position of chief of police and had heard about Byron Engel's program in Washington, applied, and of course he was exactly the sort of person they were looking for to send abroad. Diligent, hardworking.
Dan exemplified the highest principles of the police profession, that of social service. He served in Brazil for 7 years, at the International Police Academy in Washington for two, and in Montevideo for one. There are 250 million people in Latin America. In many of these countries, the communist terrorists are trying to tear the fabric of democracy apart. Some of these countries, Uruguay among them, realize that the best protection against this is the development of a democratic police and have asked the United States to help. And this is what Dan was doing in Uruguay.
He went to Uruguay to get information.
This is part of the testimony of Manuel Oevia of Uruguay. He said regarding Mitrione, this question of perfectionism, he insisted on an economy of effort. He used to say precise pain in the precise place at the precise time.
One of the pieces of equipment that had been found useful was a wire so very thin that it could be fitted into the mouth between the teeth, and by pressing against the gums increased the electrical charge. And it was through the diplomatic pouches that Mitrione got some of the equipment he needed for the interrogations, including these fine wires.
Several street beggars were picked up whose disappearance would attract no attention. This was a technique that Mitrione had developed, or rather perfected, in Brazil. Using these beggars, experiments were conducted with different forms of interrogation, letting the students see the effects of different voltages on different parts of the human body, male and female. All those unhappy people died without really knowing why they were undergoing this pain.
That was former CIA case officer John Stockwell there, relating his experiences of working within the US intelligence services. Sounds like they picked up pretty much where the Nazis left off, doesn't it? And more from John in future weeks.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Jeff Sparks, what's on this week?
Thank you, Tony. Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday 23rd of May, The Creep Show will be performing with support from Pussycat and the Dirty Johnsons and also the Montgomerys at the Exchange in Old Market, Bristol. Tickets are £12 in advance and doors open at 7pm. Also on 23rd of May, the David Bowie tribute, Absolute Bowie, will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30pm. On to Song of the Week, I present Michael Jerome Brown. He is considered one of Canada's finest roots musicians and in his career has released 5 studio albums. This is from his first album, Drive On, which was released in 2002, and is the song, The Path You Leave Behind.
Accept love to be your guide. Give your children love and care. Give your children love and care. Give your children love and care. They are treasure beyond compare.
The Path You Leave Behind from the album Drive On. For more information, you can check out www.michaelsharonebrown.com. Keeping with Friday 23rd of May, The Members will be performing with support from Viva La Punk and also Stiff Little Bristols at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30pm. Finally, on Sunday 25th of May, Paul Heaton and Jackie Abbott of Beautiful South fame will be performing with support from Cherry Ghost at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Tickets are £19.50 in advance and doors open at 7pm. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks, Jeff. That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast and is on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11am every Thursday morning. If you're offline, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. This and many others from Radio 4 All, that's radio number 4, all.org, and from bcfmradio.com/dialect. Thanks to our guests, Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire, Elliot Pablo, Jeff Sparks, and studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening, so until the same time next week, goodbye for now.